Your Honor, Jack Fuchs on behalf of the four appellants, Newell Operating Company, which is the plan sponsor, the Newell Rubbermaid Health and Welfare Program 506, which is the health plan at issue from which the benefits are provided, Newell Window Furnishes, Inc., which is the Freeport-based manufacturer and employer that makes such things as Kirsch blinds and Levalore blinds, and Newell Rubbermaid, Inc., Benefits Plans Administrative Committee, which is the fiduciary. All four entities are here. Two of those entities, namely the employer, is a proper plaintiff with respect to the LMRA claim. The fiduciary and arguably the plan are the proper parties with respect to the ERISA claim. Newell Operating Company is a necessary party in as much as it's the plan sponsor whose action is in part at issue. In this case, Your Honors, our position is that the district court committed reversible error in ignoring two decisions of this court in holding that declaratory relief under ERISA is not a cause of action that arises under ERISA 502A3, which is codified at 29 U.S.C. 1132A3. And that error involved ignoring this court's 1991 decision in Winstead versus J.C. Penney Company, in which a fiduciary, like the committee, brought a cause of action under ERISA, and this court held that there was not general federal question jurisdiction, but rather jurisdiction under 29 U.S.C. 1132E1, that is, mandatory jurisdiction for hearing an ERISA claim. In reaching that conclusion, the Seventh Circuit, this court, held that the term in 502A3 or 1132A3 enforce means to enforce is to effectuate, 933 F. Second at 579. What is the significance? The significance is that a declaratory judgment enforces the terms of a plan by delineating and determining, giving effect to, the rights and duties that the fiduciaries have. The district court did not mention Winstead, ignored it completely. As a matter of fact, the appellee's briefs do not mention Winstead. We made that argument in opposition to the motions to dismiss. At least the UAW does reference the second case from the Seventh Circuit. It's the case involving Spitz versus Tepfer. In Spitz versus Tepfer, again, you have a fiduciary, just like the committee, bringing an action, claiming that we have a need for a declaratory judgment. The district court said there is jurisdiction. It's under the traditional 28 U.S.C. 1331 federal question. The cause of action doesn't necessarily arise under ERISA, although it involves a federal question. Therefore, no attorney's fees are to be awarded. This court reversed the decision of the district court and said, no, this case actually arises under ERISA 502A3, for which jurisdiction is proper under 29 U.S.C. 1132E1 again. And in that circumstance, attorney's fees may properly be awarded to the fiduciary that prevailed. The district court instead decided that the only jurisdiction in this case is the 28 U.S.C. 1331 and said if there's any relief, it's not going to be under ERISA. It's going to be under the Declaratory Judgment Statute, Declaratory Judgment Act at 28 U.S.C. 2201. The district court erred under the precedent of this court. The district court, and the point that we're making is that where ERISA creates a cause of action, and then also Congress creates the cause of action in enacting ERISA, and Congress sets forth the jurisdictional provision, you do not have the same may or may not apply application that would normally arise in the construction of a declaratory judgment act. That's not to say that our complaint didn't plead in the alternative of the Declaratory Judgment Act. We did. But the district court erred in light of these two Seventh Circuit decisions. The district court...
Well, isn't your injunctive relief claim basically the same as your declaratory relief claim?
It is very difficult to distinguish declaratory relief and injunctive actions. I think that...
Because how would you, what would it mean to enjoin the retirees here?
Well, actually, in this case, there is meaning to enjoining retirees. It is retirees, if you want to submit claims for retiree health benefits, before you do so, you have to pay your premiums on a monthly basis, and you have to pay the co-pays that the plan says. There is a separate injunctive concept or part of this case. The district court said they're all the same. Our point would be, even if they're all the same, Seventh Circuit precedent says that's fine, it arises under ERISA. But more significantly, this is a proper case for injunctive relief. This is a situation where we're seeking, with respect to the individual retirees, an order saying, please, if you're going to submit these, you have to comply with the terms of a plan. And that's expressly what 502A3 says a fiduciary can do under ERISA, that is, as a cause of action.
But, I mean, part of why the district court said that the injunctive claim was very similar to the declaratory relief claim is that the declaratory relief claim was not to enforce a provision of ERISA.
Well, actually, it's to enforce a term of the plan. And under 502A3, what that provision says is that a fiduciary may bring an injunctive relief action or other appropriate equitable relief with respect to terms of the plan or terms of ERISA. So this is actually directed toward a term of the plan, namely requiring the individuals to comply with the copay and the premium requirements that the plan imposes. Now, this court has on at least two occasions said essentially that injunctive relief and declaratory relief are really opposite sides of the same coin. That a declaratory judgment is a judgment that determines rights, often to be enforced through a subsequent injunctive action. This isn't, by the way, a claim for damages. That's why it's equitable relief. We're not saying, retirees, you owe us this money. What we're saying is, as injunctive relief, if you're going to be submitting claims and participating under the terms of the plan, you must comply with those plan terms. And that is a very different scenario, and it does follow the injunctive approach that is authorized. Two cases that this court has noted that injunctive relief and declaratory relief really go hand in hand are the Bonkowski versus Smith case at 305 F3rd 757 and the health cost containers case or containment case at 187 F3rd, I believe it's 703. In both of those cases, this court, noted that when you look at is there appropriate declaratory relief or is there an appropriate injunction, what you're doing is determining rights. In an injunction, you're ordering certain action based on that determination. In a pure declaratory relief case, you're not ordering any further action, but what you're doing is identifying what that relief is. With respect to the UAW, Your Honors, there is actually yet another case that the district court addressed and actually glossed over in a footnote, and which both the UAW and the retirees says, I think you just got wrong. And that's the J.W. Peters case. In J.W. Peters, LMRA, like ERISA, has a creation of a cause of action, that is, actions for breach of contract that are collective bargaining agreements. The same section, same statute, 29 U.S.C. 185 LMRA 301, it's the same statute, both creates the cause of action in one section, one subsection. In a separate subsection, it creates the jurisdiction. And what this court in Peters says is, in this case, by contrast, Peters was accused of violating the terms of the collective bargaining agreement by attempting to terminate the collective bargaining relationship without providing proper notice. Peters sought declaratory relief from this alleged violation. This is a suit, quote, for a violation of contracts within the meaning of Section 301. In our case, the employer, like Peters, seeks a declaration under the LMRA that its amendment of retiree health benefit costs is not a violation of a variety of collective bargaining agreements which differ among their various terms. As this court held only 3 years ago, this is a suit for violation of contracts within the meaning of 301. We have a situation in this case where we are very much different from a traditional Declaratory Judgment Act case, that is, for which the subject matter jurisdiction arises under the federal question jurisdiction under 1331. Final point. The district judge erroneously weighed the factors and, quite honestly, made up some of the factors. The employer has been in Freeport since 1998, 8 years before the lawsuit, not just shortly before the case was filed, as the district court held. The plan has been administered for the retirees in Freeport, different building in Freeport, in the Northern District, Western Division, since 1998. 8 years before.
So in terms of the procedural history, the committee wasn't added as a plaintiff until the second amended complaint was filed. Is that right?
That is true, Your Honor.
And shouldn't we consider this suit as being filed after the Michigan action in light of that?
Well, there are two reasons for saying no to that. Well, three reasons at least. One, when you take a look at the Michigan pleading alleges that Newell Operating Company and Newell Window Furnishings are the fiduciary. When you actually look at the Michigan case, that's in the record at 429 as Exhibit A, I believe. It identifies those entities. Second response, Your Honor, is under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and Amendment, the relation back under 15A takes the filing back to the original filing.
Aren't there some cases that go with regard to ERISA, does it create a problem there?
I'm sorry, with respect
to ERISA, to your ERISA claim relating back?
Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm unaware of any such claims that would relate, that would cause such a problem on a relation back in this context. I see I'm within my time. I should mention three very quick points. One, before the court was the fact that the UAW would be and has subsequently been dismissed. Two, there is no class action in the Western District of Michigan. We're going to be subjected to multiple lawsuits. At this point, the time for filing the motion for class cert has come and passed, and no such motion was filed. Three, we haven't even received the Rule 26 disclosures from the retirees in that case. The only place where all parties could be, the only place where the union all the retirees and all the interested parties could be brought in, is the Northern District of Illinois. The 79 people in Indiana were not appropriate, for example, in the Western District of Michigan. Thank you for your time. I see that my time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Einstein?
May it please the Court, I'm Stan Eisenstein. I'm representing the International Union UAW. I was also representing Local 9, UAW Local 797 in the first and the original complaints. It's since been dropped.
Could you address that last point he made, that this Northern District of Illinois is the only place where all the parties are, and so it's an appropriate venue? I know you have your argument planned, but if you could address that, that would be helpful.
Fair enough. And if I could make a preliminary comment before.
All right.
Mike Fayette is the counsel representing some of the individual retirees. He's going to be addressing the ERISA end. My argument is going to focus solely on the Section 301 breach of contract claim. So I wanted that known to Your Honor, because I think he also will address it. With respect to the argument that the Northern District is the only place that this case can be heard, it's just wrong for the following multiple reasons. First of all, in the section, the Northern District on the 301 case, there are none of the individual named defendants are located here. The only reason he makes plaintiffs make that argument that the Northern District is the only place to litigate this case, assuming in any retiree insurance case you have to name 400 or 40,000 if it was the case of GM or Ford, is under the ERISA aspect of the case. For the 301 aspect of the case, none of the retirees are located here, and the UAW, other than nominally having another regional office in the state of Illinois, has no connection with the Northern District. And therefore, if plaintiffs wanted to proceed solely on the 301 action, they absolutely could have filed it in the Western District of Michigan under that theory. Judge Reinhardt had it mostly right. At the end of the day,
You don't want to give them too much.
No, I don't want to give them too much, because I would like to argue with Judge Reinhardt's footnote 1 at the end of his minute opinion, in which he perhaps decided that there might be jurisdiction on the 301 case for a deck action by an employer, notwithstanding the Supreme Court's holding in Textron. Judge Reinhardt cited to the Peters case and said arguably there might be jurisdiction, but he had it right in saying he didn't have to reach that esoteric issue. And respectfully, I suggest that this court doesn't have to reach the issue of whether or not there's jurisdiction in a declaratory action when the employer is not contending the entire agreement is invalid. I'm suggesting that what Judge Reinhardt did is cut through all of that and said, even if the DEC declaratory judgment 301 jurisdiction existed in the Northern District, he was exercising his discretion to dismiss the case because he found quite correctly that every indicia that governs venue favored the litigation proceeding on the 301 action in the Western District of Michigan. And I suggest that's a very common sense, proper, and more importantly for this court's standard of review, it was not an abuse of discretion for Judge Reinhardt to reach that conclusion. The fact is the Northern District has no connection with the 301 aspects of this case. Mr. Fayette will address, I think, the balance of your question, Judge Williams, regarding the ERISA end. I'd rather prefer to do that. Mr. Fayette is also the attorney who is representing all the parties in the Western District. My job, when the UAW needed defendants, was to get me out of the case and get the case transferred to the Western District of Michigan. And Judge Reinhardt correctly concluded that. And I don't think the plaintiffs' appellants can point to a single fact that shows that Judge Reinhardt abused his discretion in determining that venue simply didn't belong here. I will cede the rest of my argument to Mr. Fayette. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr.
May it please the Court, I'm Mike Fayette. I represent four of the over 400 individual retiree defendants in this case. I also represent the plaintiffs in the Michigan action. I would like to inform the Court that we have not abandoned the Michigan action, class action. I know what happened, but I don't know why. The date was miscalendared for 3/31 instead of 1/31. By the end of this week, we expect to file a motion for class certification and another motion to extend the dates in the scheduling order. I suspect that my embarrassment over this still shows on my face. And that error obviously may affect my ability to serve as class counsel, but I don't think it will affect the ultimate filing of the motion. As to the merits of this case, this is the most awkward case with which I've ever been associated. The awkwardness, I think, is due to the attempt by the employer to shoehorn this into the Sixth Circuit instead of the Seventh Circuit. I've never seen a case where an employer sued every defendant of a large ERISA plan individually, and I've never seen the consternation that this has caused for those individuals to be sued in a faraway jurisdiction to actually be a defendant. I've never seen a case either where an employer, after it acquired a company and closed down the company and moved the remains of that company to a warehouse in a distant location, has claimed jurisdiction over either an ERISA or a 301 action in that remote jurisdiction. This awkwardness, though, the way this case was brought, also caused it to be very difficult to see the forest for the trees, and I missed a point that I will bring up in a moment. I didn't see it until I re-reviewed the appellant's reply brief last week.
Has no fiduciary committee been added as a defendant in the Michigan action?
No, Your Honor, and we won't add them as a defendant. When I first started bringing these cases in the early 1980s, we regularly added the fiduciary as a defendant. But typically, the sponsor properly amends the plan, and when I mean properly, they actually amend the plan according to ERISA, to allow them to take the action that they did. So the fiduciary gets to rely on the Nuremberg defense. They applied the plan as written, and they are out of the cases. And we stopped adding them because we were afraid we were going to get sanctioned for bringing them because there was no fiduciary claim. I'd love to be able to bring fiduciary claims because it opens the door for larger damages for the retirees, but we typically cannot do that. So we do not do that. The object of this suit is absolutely clear. There's no lack of clarity there. The second amended complaint states the dispute between the parties is whether Newell may amend or modify the plan. And that would only be inhibited by the underlying collective bargaining agreements. The importance of this is not in the $40 that they are attempting to charge the retirees at this time. The importance lies in the fact that once a change like that goes into effect and goes unchallenged, it opens the door for further changes to the point of complete elimination of the benefits. With regard to count one, the committee's action for equitable relief is brought under 502A3. The district court was absolutely correct in determining that the fiduciary, the committee here, is not trying to enforce anything. Rather, the committee is seeking to have the court validate the sponsor's amendment to the plan. The fiduciary has no horse in that race whatsoever. They merely enforce the plan as written. Fiduciary is serving as a stalking horse here. There's no provision under 502A3 to allow it to do that. And the court was absolutely correct in saying the plan was not trying to enforce a single provision of ERISA. There was no abuse of discretion by the court in so ruling. The district court also properly characterized count two as a declaratory action by Newell. As to the fiduciary, as noted before, there's no standing. As to Newell, there's no basis for bringing a declaratory judgment in this court. With regard to the UAW, there is no actual legal controversy since the UAW cannot sue Newell. Newell made this very clear in its reply brief. There at page 13, Newell argues that no court other than the Northern District has jurisdiction because the UAW was dismissed in the Michigan case. It finally hit me. There's no controversy between the UAW and Newell. Therefore, the sole defendant that Newell finds in the Northern District, the UAW, has no beef with Newell. It can't sue Newell. So there's no actual controversy necessary for declaratory judgment here. And there's no defendant with regard to the retirees present in the Northern District of Illinois. The addresses are listed in the heading of the second amended complaint, that 50-page heading, and not a single one of them is within that district. Again, the court did not abuse its discretion. And finally, as to count three, we have the same issue. The UAW does not have a dispute with Newell that can be justiciable in this court. It cannot sue Newell. So therefore, there's no venue in that court with regard to any defendant with which it may have an actual controversy under Section 301. The district court got it absolutely right when it determined that the proper place for this litigation is in Michigan. The vast majority of the retirees are located there. The factory was located there. The retirees gave their services there. The contracts were negotiated there. The contracts were applied for over two decades in that location before Newell even bought Kirsch. Newell is a stranger to this case. And by moving the plan and the records to Rockford, Illinois, it attempts to take that case away from the retirees in Michigan. We respectfully request that the court affirm the district court's decision. Thank you.
What's the difference of the status of the case in Michigan be if there was this case were transferred as opposed to the dismissal?
It would be unmanageable, Your Honor. You can't. The only resolution to such a case with 400 defendants or 400 plaintiffs, depending on how you would do it, is to try the case. You can never get specific agreement from 400 individuals as to any settlement. And I can't imagine what a trial would be like in that case. The only proper way to bring these is a class action plaintiff's suit. That way, if there is a potential settlement, and 95% of them are settled, if not more, the court then can invoke the provisions of the class action rules of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure to protect the class and allow for objections to the settlement if there that occurs. We do that. I've probably settled three dozen of these in the Western District through that procedure. It will be impossible to settle it if every one of the retirees is an actual party in interest. Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.